You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
War, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
What am I, a doctor or a moon shuttle conductor?
I'm a doctor, not a bricklayer.
No, I'm a doctor, not a mechanic. I'm a doctor, not an engineer.
No, you're an engineer.
Not a magician, Spock, just an old country doctor.
But I'm a doctor, not a botanist. I'm a doctor, not an historian.
I am a doctor, not a voyeur.
I shouldn't have to remind you, I'm a doctor.
Not an engineer.
I'm a doctor, not a performer.
I'm a doctor, not a counterinsurgent.
I'm a doctor, not a database.
I'm a doctor, not a doorstop.
I'm a doctor, not a peeping Tom.
I'm a doctor, not a battering.
I'm a doctor, not a dragon slayer.
I'm a doctor, not a zookeeper.
I'm a doctor, not an engineer.
I'm a physician, not an engineer.
I'm a doctor, Jim. I'm physical. Damn it, man, I'm a doctor, not a physicist.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is Conspiracy.
I'm a doctor, not a commando.
I'm Colin from England.
And I'm James from London, also in England.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska, not in England. Yes, and tonight we have another guest who wanted to be on, and we're talking about Colin, also from England. Where at in England are you from, Colin?
I'm in Warwickshire, which is slap bang in the middle.
I'm sorry, I would consider Warwickshire to be like way north.
Yeah, because you're in London. Everything outside the M25 is north to London.
I know, I'm sorry. I am sorry. And actually, today I'm actually in Brighton, of all places. I've come down to Brighton for the day.
Oh, you're even further south then.
So we're actually on the coast. So everything is north, even London at this point.
See, now, if Tanya and Adam wasn't in Copenhagen, you could have popped over to some of your fellow trek mates and had a beer.
All right, Colin. So tell me what you do. What do you do for a living? What kind of work are you into?
I drive intercity trains.
You're the conductor, huh?
No, I'm the driver.
Isn't that a conductor?
No.
Oh.
Conductor's the guy who does the tickets.
Oh, I see. And Sheldon Cooper loves trains.
Yes.
That's great.
As long as it's the right gauge.
See, now you two would be perfect. James is a theoretical physicist, just like Sheldon. James, do you like trains?
Not particularly.
Ah, oh, Lord. I tried.
No, we live in London.
You don't have trains in London?
Yeah, they have the tube, which is one of the most unreliable things on the planet.
Oh, yeah. James always says, I just got off the train. So, you got trains. And yeah, that's why you don't like it, because you have to take it all the time.
Yeah, the tube is it's an interesting experience, to say the least, in London. No one makes eye contact. No one talks to each other. Everyone looks at the feet.
I'm now going to have to defend the London Underground, so the tube, as it is. Because the London Underground is generally great, right? It's got such a huge number of people going through it every single day. I think they said that it's almost like one in two of every people in the country that is on a train is on the London Underground. So it's a massive operation. Now, yes, it's not, sometimes it doesn't quite work perfectly. But I generally get home okay every day.
So it's I'm going to come out as a fan in London, of the
tube. That is absolutely true. If you want to do any kind of distance in London, you have to go by tube. Buses, you can handle, shorter distances, but really it's the tube or nothing.
Mm. Okay. And Colin, you used to do a podcast. What do you do now? Anything? Or just
I still do podcasts.
There we go. That's what I wanted to hear. Now, what do you tell everyone where you could be found?
Well, you can find me on at the moment. You can find me on three places.
you can find me on Trek FM doing Melodic Treks, which is an exploration of the music side of Star Trek, the composers, the tracks, the inspiration, that type of thing. You can find me on Hollow Sweet Media, where we do a Battlestar Galactica podcast. And if you're a YouTube user and you go to the Sci-Fi Diner podcast on YouTube, then I edit that.
But are you on it, though?
Nah. Okay. I'm the behind-the-scenes guy.
Okay. Yeah, after Trek News and Views, I really didn't realize that you were on another podcast, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, Trek News and Views, I quit while I was on ahead. Yeah, it was a massive, massive show. I had so much fun doing it. And, you know, I mean, you know as well as I do, Lou, when you started, there was like probably two or three Star Trek podcasts, and mm-hmm. there's like hundreds.
Yeah.
So rather than wait for a slow death, while it was hitting massive figures, I went out on a high.
Good. Nice. Well, let's hope that we can get massive figures someday. But we're not going to go out. We still got six or six.
Next Generation is the most watched incarnation of Star Trek.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, you know, we're one of a number of podcasts about it, so some are gooder, some are better, some are worse.
Yeah, but you're the only one with a doc.
The only one with the doctor. That's correct. Okay. All right, then. Why don't you go ahead and head on into the synopsis, unless there's anything else you want to tell us.
No. I do think now that the Doc should be introduced with the Doctor Who music.
Oh, good, no. If anything, you know what I would actually put is Bones in somewhere in the intro. You know, maybe I'll play with that this one. We'll see how it works out. But yeah, we'll put Bones in the intro, you know. So some reason you want my atom spread across the galaxy, boy? I don't know, maybe. But, you know, the point of the intro is to draw out the battle bridge, and there was only three times that the battle bridge was ever even mentioned.
Yeah, but everyone knew it was there.
Exactly. So, and yeah. I like that one where,
except for in the Best of Both Worlds, when they actually went into the toilet to go to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. You're right. They did. Yeah, you know, and I like the last one that says it's, what is it, transferring command to the battle bridge, and then we take over. Yeah, you know, so I like that. But anyway, okay, why don't you go on in.
Right, the synopsis for tonight's show is: after Captain Picard receives a stark warning from an old end, the Enterprise returns to Earth to stop an alien invasion from taking over Starfleet Command. This is the 25th episode of Season 1 of Star Trek The Next Generation. The release date is May the 9th, 1988. I bet that makes some people feel old. Mm-hmm. This episode was written by Robert Sapiroff and Tracy Torm and directed by Cliff Boll, who is a brilliant director. And guest stars include Henry Darrow as Savar, Ward Costello as Gregory Quinn, Robert Shenkan, I hope I've said that right, as Dexter Remick, Ray Reinhardt as Aaron, Jonathan Farewell as Walter Keel, Michael Berryman as Captain Ricks, and Ursuline Bryant as Captain Tyler Scott. So, what do we think of this episode? Personally, I think this is one of the best episodes of Season 1.
Yes. What about you, James?
Well, it doesn't have a huge amount of competition, though, does it?
It doesn't, but this to me is proper Star Trek.
No, I agree with you. I agree. I certainly think it, I mean, I think it often gets cited as being the best episode of Season 1. I'm not quite there. I think it's the second best episode of Season 1. And I actually think it's really good. And I think you can watch this, you know, some of the early Season 1 stuff you don't really want to watch if you've kind of caught TNG from like Season 3 onwards. I think this one, I think this one stands up, personally.
What's your best one from Season 1 then, James?
Where No One's Gone Before. That's my favourite.
Mm-hmm. That got a 5 out of him.
Yeah, it did. Not Paris then.
Have you heard?
Yes, I did listen to the last show, yes.
No, I wanted to love it so much.
Yeah, but the scientist in you wouldn't let you.
Apparently not.
I did want to ask a question about that. The bit at the end where there's three Daitas, mm-hmm. and they're all talking to each other in real time. Shouldn't there have been a time lag?
I think, because
technically that was in three different time zones.
It depends whether or not there's. I mean, because they did have the interaction right on the turbo lift as well, where people from the future are able to talk to people
in the past,
and so they didn't seem to suggest there was. It didn't seem to suggest that it was somehow kind of disconnected, but it did look like you could interact with yourself in the different timelines. Like easily, so I don't know.
Talk to myself in the past, I could stop myself doing some really dumb things.
No, absolutely. I don't quite see where they were going with their use of time travel on that one.
I thought when he says next week we're doing this, I thought James is going to have a problem with that one.
Really?
Because it's a scientist, you see things different.
Yes, but as I've mentioned a lot, I don't think that just because you're a scientist or just because you're a doctor or just because you haven't had a bit of experience, you have to demand 100% accuracy. Having said that, there are instances where you don't want the kind of stuff that you're interested in just to be reduced down to absurd situations that take you out of the drama. And I think that the good episodes are the ones that are able to balance those two competing things, because if you're purely 100% scientific, or if you're purely even if you take it out of sci-fi, go into like a legal drama, if you're 100% accurate, then you're probably doing paperwork for 99% of your day. It's not it's not really what you want to see. So you want to balance the drama on one side with the accuracy on the other, and as long as it just doesn't, it's a fine line. And I think Trek, better than most sci-fi, I think Trek actually kind of walks it pretty well.
The clue's in the name and all, it's science fiction.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway, Lou, what do you think of these?
I'm sorry, what? I agree with everything. No, yeah, you're absolutely right. While there is some reason to think the science should be somewhat accurate, like you say, it is fiction, you got to look past.
And about conspiracy, because we're actually talking about conspiracy today.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a question. Did either of you, both of you, listen to the beginning of Skin of Evil?
You mean the podcast?
Yes,
or the
our podcast. Yes, our podcast.
I have not got to it yet. I'm on Symbiosis.
Okay. Have you, Colin?
Yeah, I've listened to all of them.
Okay. Do you remember, James, when we were introducing ourselves, Ben introduced himself, you introduced yours, and I said, "And I'm Lou. Why have you..." Do you remember me doing that?
Yeah, sure.
I was going to take that out and just say, I'm Lou from the Rep, but then all of a sudden, it struck me, I'm playing around with an Audacity, and just wait till you see how it came out. It was kind of funny, actually. You think, Colin?
Yeah, I thought it was, you definitely did the right thing leaving it in.
yeah, it was fun because I reverbed it, mixed it, and it was fun.
So, Lou, should we do some forum feedback?
Oh, yeah. Where'd we leave off?
I believe we are today reviewing feedback for the Arsenal of Freedom.
The Arsenal Hall of Freedom. Oh, Arsenal of Freedom. Oh, there's only one. Wasn't there only one last week, too?
I believe there were six last week, five of which were telling you to post the show.
Which is by, one was by Colin, yeah, telling me. So, yeah, who's going to be joining us for this episode, Conspiracy? So, okay, yeah, Kieran McDuff again.
People, Lou, people know that by now.
Oh, I know.
This is terrible. So actually, I think first things first, I think we should give a big thanks for Blair coming on to the show for the Arsenal of Freedom. He was a great guest, and we look forward to having him on next season as well. Because he was a very good contributor, and it was very good and happy doing the show with him.
Absolutely, but yes.
Shall I take the feedback from Kieran McDuff that we've received?
Yeah, please. Yeah, I read the last one. It's your turn.
Okay. So Kira McDuff has posted, he said, "This is definitely one of the better episodes from season one. The premise of a planet that sells weapons is sound and seems something like the Ferengi would run. The fact that it's deserted is also a sound premise, given the weapons exterminated everyone, although it's not clear whether this was part of a war or just part of a sales demo. Dragging the main characters down to the planet was slightly convoluted. The initial away team makes sense, as does Dr. Crusher beaming down to deal with Riker, but there's no reason for Picard to go down with her, especially since there are a lot of people down there already. After that, splitting the away team into two separate stories was pretty good. The drama against the ever-increasing powerful weapons kept us questioning how we would defeat them, while Picard trying to help the seriously injured Crusher built on their relationship nicely. Throwing the curveball of Picard being the one to stop the weapons attacking the others was a good move as well. Doing so in a very simple way was terrific. Even the story on the ship worked well. LaForge, still a junior officer, grew into the role he had been thrown into by circumstance. Having Troy with him probably helped a bit, which is nice for her to do something useful for a change. Geordi's performance is certainly notable, given that Chief Logan nipping at him at every opportunity. No wonder he disappeared, never to be seen again. He was dreadful. You nailed it when you pointed out he was never happy and constantly wanting Geordi to do the opposite to what he was doing. It's hard to fault this episode. Picard going down to the planet aside, it's a solid story from all angles. I'd be harsh to mark it down for the Picard decision, so I'm going to give it top marks. 5 out of 5.
Okay, 5 out of 5.
Okay. So I think that... I've actually only recently listened to the Arsenal of Freedom pod that we put out, because I've developed a bit of a backlog, so apologies there. But it's, I think we mentioned at the time, it's a very solidly put together episode, and I think that a lot of Kieran's comments were kind of expressed through the show. So it's always good to hear feedback. So thank you very much for that, Kieran.
Yeah, thank you. I gave it a 3.5. You gave it a 4, and Blair gave it a 4 as well. So that's pretty good. All right, thank you. Yeah, I agree. Geordi really does shine. I mean, before the commercial break, you see him backing up and he calls for Logan and you think, oh my goodness, he's done. He can't handle the stress. Then he comes back, takes over. This is what we're going to do, and he works out perfect. So I agree with him on that. Thank you. Okay. Well then, let's head on in to conspiracy. Before we go into conspiracy, I want a little diversion. You guys got a few minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. Last week, James, we were talking about the British version of Life on Mars with Paul. Do you remember that?
I do remember that, and I was not aware that there was a non-British version of Life on Mars.
Yes. Well, obviously, there's no way I was going to find it, so I did the way of getting the episodes that probably shouldn't be done the way I did it. But I had to, because there's no way I was going to find it here.
You didn't go on Netflix, did you?
No, I didn't. They're not on Netflix.
Okay, carry on. I'm not going to knock you off.
Are they on Netflix?
I have no idea.
I don't believe they are, but I went ahead and, you know, I found them. No, we'll leave it at that. And I started watching them. And it's amazing how much the series are, I mean, the scripts are pretty much the same. The only thing I'm seeing is culture differences and differences in the, like, for instance, Sam Tyler over here is a detective, whereas over there he's a detective inspector. His boss over here is Gene Hunt, who's a lieutenant, and over there it's a detective chief inspector, I believe it's called.
Over here, yeah.
Yeah, over there. So, you know, there's differences. I don't know what you call the police officers besides Bobby's.
Police officers.
Are they? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, there's a couple, like, in our version, we have Sizable Ted, who's another detective. Over there is no such Sizable Ted. Now, here's the thing. Colin, are you familiar with the U.S. version of Life on Mars at all?
No.
Okay. Over there, Annie is named Annie Cartwright. Over here, she's named Annie Norris. So that way, all the guys can call her No Nuts Norris. because in 1973 she was part of a women's police bureau, which is absolutely nothing in the police department. It's just she puts on the soft face for when she needs to talk to grieving people or kid children or whatever. But beyond that, they consider her useless. What's another difference here? Ray Carling. Ray is totally different here, and I believe our version of Ray is a whole lot better. He delivers one lines and so on. But here's the thing. Two things. Annie, I believe in the British version, is actually nicer. I think she's cuter. Perhaps a little bit chunky. I mean, in the face. But yeah, I think she's prettier than our Hollywood gussied up Annie. And Gene Hunt, obviously, is a hell of a lot more grittier. Matter of fact, they all are. I mean, these guys are great. But there's one episode that's the same. Sam wants to take down the mob boss. And so the mob boss sends one of his girls to his apartment. I'm scared, Sam. He's going to kill me. He's going to do, you know, awful mean things. I need to stay here. And throughout the night, he ends up going on an LSD-induced trip and has sex with this girl, who takes pictures of him. Now, the difference in the U.S. version to the British version, in the U.S. version, you know they're having sex, okay? But in the British version, she jumps up and you see her everything from the stomach up. So my curious question to you guys is, how much nudity is allowed on the BBC?
Basically, we have over here what's called the watershed, which is 9 p.m., and after 9 p.m., they're allowed to show boobs and bums and stuff like that. So Life on Mars was on after 9 p.m., mm-hmm. So it was after the watershed, so therefore it was allowed. But they do put warnings on the front of the programs. This program contains violence, nudity, swearing, stuff like that, and it's in all the TV guides as well. So there's lots of, ways that people know roughly what's contained in a show.
Okay. Yeah, I'd say Ray Carling is better in the U.S. version. Ray Carling in the British version just seems like a Neanderthal. I wasn't sure what his role was, but that's pretty much it. Oh, another thing I liked was Fletcher. In the British version, his name is Glenn Fletcher. He's like Sam's mentor when he came on to the force. And in the U.S. version, it's the same thing, only he's Fletcher Bellows. And I kind of like our version of Fletcher a little bit better. He's, kind of lived through the BLA, the Black Liberation Army. And he just, the face on the older man is just, I don't know, he's just more fatherly than the BBC. But after Ray and Fletcher, yeah, the BBC, I think, is better. I do believe it's better. But I'm glad I watched the U.S. version first, because had I gone through the British version and then started watching the U.S. version, I would have thought that it's just a knockoff. What would be the point? Well, let's start off with the first officer's log. Someone has gone out of their way to prevent this ship from visiting the ocean world of Pacifica. We were looking forward to the warm blue waters and the fine beaches that make Pacifica the jewel of the galaxy. That is, of course, at least until Ryza comes along. Someone is going to lose their head. End of log.
By the way, first, I need to bring in an apology at this point, because over the last couple of weeks, I have insisted, or at least believed, that Picard meets all of the captains on Pacifica, and he doesn't. It's just that they're on the way to Pacifica when they get diverted. So I've been putting out false information for the last couple of weeks.
Oh my goodness, I can't believe that. I don't remember any of that. Yeah, no, that's not the ocean world of Pacifica.
No, it's kind of barren of water, if it is.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah.
Okay.
Although it does come equipped with a standard Starfleet cave.
Yeah, that's true. And, an interesting bridge that just happened to be built there.
Yeah, for dramatic effect, you say.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
That's what it is. You come down them steps, you go into the cave, and at the back of the cave, that's where the water is for Pacifica.
That could be. Geordi. All right. So we join the crew with Geordi telling a joke already in progress, and it goes like this. Quote, so the guy staggers to his feet, goes back to the girl, right? Well, she smiles, looks him straight in the eye, and says, just try that in hyperspace. Just try. Okay, I don't get it. What was the first part of the joke? All we have is Data coming back with, so the difficulty in attaining such complex position in zero gravity environment, coupled with the adverse effects it would have on the psychological well-being of the average human male, is what makes this antidote so amusing. Okay, guys, we have to reconstruct this joke. Any chance you guys can figure it out?
No. I don't even think Geordi's visor could fizzle it out.
But I get the impression that if we did, we would lose the family-friendly rating on this.
Oh.
I think they're going, I think they're hinting of stuff that we probably wouldn't be discussing.
And it's also a foretelling for later on in the run where Data tries comedy with Guinan.
Actually, by the way, one of the things I have in my notes, and I have to say this, I think Brent Spiner laughs as Data really well. The really bad laughing that he does is, I think it's pretty hard to pull off. And I do like it when he sits there and he does his, and I like that.
Yeah.
Was that close?
Yeah, not bad. Okay. And then he just turns it off.
Do you think this laugh though, James, or do you think the Q given laugh?
Actually, the Q laugh is also quite good.
Yeah, I mean, Q grants him humor.
Yeah, right.
As a reward.
Yeah, well, the Q thing was a hearty belly laugh.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, well, anyway, we're trucking along, and it will take 22 hours to get to those blue waters, and that's just not soon enough. So, Riker orders an increase to Warp 6, but what does LaForge do? I have never seen such a clear-cut, blatant example of insubordination. Ever on Star Trek. He drops to full impulse.
I mean, I noticed that. I think it's very clear that, you know, going back to rewatch some of the stuff early on, you realize all the writers don't quite know what impulse and warp is, that they're messing things up here.
Yeah. Well, you're the mathematician. I was going to ask, if it would have taken 22 hours to arrive, and they're obviously traveling anywhere between warp 1 and 5, how long would it take at impulse? But obviously, since you don't know what current warp they're traveling, it'd be too hard to do the calculations. But you would assume that it'd probably be, what, a couple hundred years?
I seem to remember hearing that like warp 5 is like 100 times faster than the speed of light, and I think impulse is around a 25% of speed of light. So you're probably talking 500 years. Yeah,
they actually say in an episode of Voyager, the 37s, mm-hmm. they actually say that the Voyager, it gives Amelia Earhart the speeds of Voyager, and he actually says to her, and it cruises at warp 6, and I think he said warp 6 is like 9 billion miles a minute, I think he says, mm-hmm. something like that.
Yes, I used to have that calculation written down, but it's gone.
Yeah, it's in the episode 37s anyway.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, and he actually gives an actual speed for a warp speed.
Okay. Well, you know, it really doesn't matter because, you know, we're not really going there anyway.
I can imagine right now that Ben and Mark are screaming at this podcast because they would both know.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. So, Ben, how fast did he say in the 37s? That, I know that was your favorite episode you gave it a 5. Hey, you know, Ben's the one that tells us every Star Trek gets a 5. Or was it just TNG? I'm not sure. So, anyway, so go on.
Sorry, this is me. I was about to. I think you're headed in the same direction as I am, though, at this point, which is, I think, the only small nitpick that I have for the episode, or one of the very few ones, is that Data's written very badly. And in particular, mm-hmm. when he starts about swimming in moonlight, I can't stand it.
Okay.
The whole? You think Data's bad in the whole episode, James?
I've got a little one here that she's been down with her grandmother all week, and I've just come back. and she's not leaving me alone here.
Aye.
So she's been
joys,
having
the joys of parenthood, Mike. Don't worry about
this,
it.
This little one's. Hello.
She's quite good, Lou. Sign her up.
Absolutely.
she's only just turned two. What are you looking at there?
Have her ask her say something about Star Trek.
She doesn't know anything about Star Trek yet.
But she could say the words, right? Say Star Trek.
No, actually, I didn't think so.
Oh.
Marina, can you say Star Trek?
There you go.
Yeah. To answer the question from... Sorry, this is not might not work as well as I had hoped. But to answer Colin...
We don't know why. Uh-huh, exactly. She agrees with us.
Yeah, she's got an inquisitive mind anyway.
Well, she certainly likes this. The thing is, the big bad thing is that I haven't actually got anything that she can play with. She's looking at my computer, and she thinks, "Hey, I've got to get me some of that."
Well, there's nothing you can do. I mean, you know, my suggestion would be let's just truck on. There's worse things you can have in the background than a beautiful little voice. So,
yeah, no one's going to moan about it, 2-year-old James.
Okay,
you just carry on.
So what I was going to suggest is that I think one of the bad things about the episode at the start is how Data is, and I've mentioned it a couple of times before. I think that Data's not his line about you can swim in moonlight is just silly. And Colin did ask, you know, do I think it's just now or Data in the entire of the episode? And I think he is, other than this line, I think he's good. But this line, for whatever reason, I just can't stand it. I don't...
Yes.
And that's what she thinks.
I disagree with her just a little bit.
It's the universal translator.
No, it's not my Nina, it's my Nini. So I think I'm right, but she may have more than on me. I'm not sure. Well, yeah. She just called me out. I don't think it's a big deal. Okay, so how about you, Mr. Worf?
Oh, that's...
Are you looking forward to the moonlight swim? Swimming is too much like bathing. Okay.
Yeah, Klingons
that's
get
what
cleaned.
I'm wondering. I wonder if there's a Federation regulation on how often you have to bathe yourself.
Well, they don't bathe, do they? They have sonic showers.
That's true. So maybe he enjoys a sonic shower, but he hates bathing.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, anyway, Picard is enjoying a nice romantic dream, probably about either, I don't know, who do you think he would be dreaming about? Mrs. Mannheim, or...
Yeah, this is after we'll always have Paris, so maybe that's what he's thinking about.
What about Gabrielle, the girl on the holodeck? What did that do to drive him away?
Or for all we know, it could be Minuet.
Oh, that's right. He did kind of like Minuet. Was getting a record just a little bit jealous. Anyway, maybe he's dreaming about all three. Picard could do such a thing. That's when we get a code 47. Okay. Here we go. I had no idea till Brian Baker pointed it out sometime last year that 47 was an in-joke for TNG. Do you think it started here?
It did start on TNG. It was the one of the writers who introduced it, and then it became prevalent through DS9, and I think Voyager is the one that has the most 47 mentions.
Okay. Well, anyway, you know, we need to verify. Is this a real code 47? My thing would be, you know, if Data says it's a code 47, it's a code 47.
Yeah. Data doesn't lie.
Data couldn't lie. Okay, so I guess the question I got for you, Colin, and James, if he's still on, is do you like to drink warm water? Water's...
Not unless it's a tea bag.
Yes, I can understand that. What about water that's been sitting on a shelf for a few hours?
No, definitely not. Most people would tip it away and pour a fresh cold.
So,
So where does the warm water come from?
Well, I'm getting there. So when Picard gets out of bed for an important video conference, and no, it's not Captain Picard Day, the captain needs a touch of water for a scratchy throat. No problem. There's one waiting for him near his bed. So I guess the question is how long do you think that glass of water has been sitting there? Or does he have a water maid that comes in and changes him fresh water every 20, 30 minutes?
That's common. A lot of people take a drink to bed.
Yeah, you could. But think I'm more worried about the fact that you can put the code 47 through directly to his bedroom without even giving him any advance warning of it. They don't wake him up. It's just, bang, hey, I'm on the view screen. What? You sleep naked? Oh, okay. Well, each to their own. I was a little bit worried about that.
I should imagine as captain of the Federation flagship, he's always going to have at least one part of his brain thinking, I might be called upon at some odd hour. So always make sure I've got my PJs on.
It makes sense. But it has some chest hairs hanging out. But you're right. How can they just, you know, quickly turn on the monitor and there's Riker watching what's going on in Picard's room? Because you never know. That could have been the night that him and Beverly were creating a little brother for Wesley.
I should imagine if he has female company, he's got a secret message he sends to Riker. Mm-hmm. You know, or maybe he does like meet the fuckers when he puts the hat on the outside of the door.
Or here it's a tie.
Yeah, he's a tie. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, the do not disturb on the computer. Walker. It's Walker Keel, right? That don't trust anyone. Isn't he the one who comes on the code 47? Okay.
Yeah.
James, I don't know if you remember this. A while back, I kept thinking for some reason, I thought Admiral Ship was destroyed. Because in the episode Coming of Age, Admiral Quinn comes aboard the Enterprise with Commander Remick to investigate what's wrong aboard the ship. And it turns out there was never anything wrong. Quinn just wanted to make sure Picard wasn't compromised by something because of things he had seen in Starfleet Command. In that review, I mentioned that I thought Quinn's ship was destroyed in this future episode, Conspiracy, which we're reviewing now. The reason I thought it is because of Walker. Walker's ship was destroyed, not Quinn's.
No, I know. I noticed that. I noticed that when I listened to Coming of Age. But I think it is also in that episode where I mentioned that we go to Pacifica when we clearly don't. So I'm not going to gloat.
Well, you know, what's interesting is in Memory Alpha, they do have a picture of Pacifica. So, I mean, I'm curious why they have a picture of Pacifica if we've never been there.
Well, this is like a trend in TNG where it's like they went to Haven, but they never actually went to the planet. You know, it's like here they're going to go to Pacifica for some R&R, I suppose, and they never actually met. It seems to me that in TNG, every time they're going to go somewhere to have some R&R, they never actually get there. So this is probably why there's holodecks, because Picard probably tells the crew that they're at Pacifica, but really they're inside the holodeck. To make up for the disappointments. I mean, Haven was the worst one because they was in orbit around the planet. And yes, they was dealing with the plague ship and all that type of stuff. But, you know, there was, what, between 800 and 1,000 people on the Enterprise, depending on what mission they're doing. Surely some of them could have gone down. Not just look out the window and wave at it going, oh, so close, but can't go.
Okay.
I think the only place we actually see him go to is Riser.
Yeah. Okay. So we get this cryptic message. Don't trust anyone. Don't take anything for granted. Did you kind of like the build-up? And do you think that, you know, thinking of the whole episode, the build-up really paid off?
I really do like the build-up. I like the fact, first of all, I mean, we've kind of touched on it. I like the fact that this comes out of Coming of Age. So we've kind of had a few hints of, you know, where we're heading. You obviously have two characters that carry over. I mean, non-main cast members that carry over. And I think that's very good. Obviously, I think first time it's been done in TNG. I like the build-up throughout the episode. And you kind of... there's a lot of mystery there. And it kind of builds and builds. And you're given, like, hints. You're given hints with the original transmission and then with the meeting. And then with the destruction of the ship, And, you know, so there is a steady build up, and I think it works effectively. I think the end, there is a point where effectively after having spent however many years or maybe however many months placing themselves in Starfleet, these guys just kind of, you know, come out of the shadows and become completely open with their plans. And I can buy that. I think that if there's any criticism that can be laid at the episode is that it kind of does do this shift from being very, very mysterious and not knowing what's going on to basically having the high kicking admiral taking out Geordi. And personally, I can buy it. I think, you know, if it's the right time for this to be enacted, then it's the right time. The fact that our heroes are there doesn't bother me too much. Let me defer to Colin.
No, I totally agree with you. I think it was just the right amount of build-up. I like the way they made a point of introducing the youngest ever Starfleet captain. Because obviously up until then, it was James T. Kirk. So that was something, which was a nod to this generation as opposed to TOS. But yeah, I think it was a good build-up, you know. I mean, you know, you had the cave, but then again, what's Star Trek without a cave? Every incarnation of Star Trek has had caves. You know, it's a staple, even in the future. There will be caves. And they will feature heavily in society, even a society that can build towers 500 feet high and fly through the stars. We will always have caves.
And this must be the second female captain, I would have thought. So I think this comes relatively close after the voyage home.
Yes.
But I think that, you know, it's good to have a female captain out there. And also, doesn't everyone love a Bolian? Or am I alone?
No, I like the Bolians. I like the Bolians. And let's not forget the guy does Picard's hair. He's a Bolian.
Yes, Mr. Mott.
Yeah.
No, yeah. And obviously, I mean, the trivia goes that they are called Bolian because after Cliff Bull, who directed this episode, and this is the first we see of the Bolians.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, that is true. They are named after Cliff Bull.
Well, anyway, Picard strolls onto the bridge and alters course. Now, you think maybe, he's up to something again. Is he going to join an energy cloud? Is he going to beam aboard another ship to destroy us again? Maybe Riker should take over the ship just in case, you know. How would that go? Like, computer, code Crazer Picard, authorization, Riker, oh my god, Theta. And then, you know, command codes automatically go to Riker just in case. What do you think?
I'd hope that they have a protocol by this point.
Well, I mean, anyone can take over the ship, he can go anywhere he wants. But he doesn't do that. But he does have Data look up the planet, and, you know, further complicates the matter of why are we going there?
Yeah, I mean, I know that they have loyalty to the captain, and you know, they're used to following orders, and basically it's a military command, so you have the chain of command and stuff like that. But, you know, you would think that someone, even Riker, would say, you know, can we have a chat in your ready room? Or something like that, just like, change course, do this, do that. Yeah, right, no problem.
Huh. And supposedly everything Picard knows, Riker is supposed to have clearance to know as well, isn't he?
Yes, that is how it works. So there's always a fail-safe. So if something happens to the captain, the next in command knows what to do to finish the
mission. Only thing about the Bolian is he wasn't blue. At least, maybe it was the light.
Yeah, I think it was the light. Because there was a lot of red in the cave scene.
I don't think he was blue, but he was blue enough for me not to have an issue with it.
Maybe he wasn't a full Bolian.
Absolutely, perhaps not. Perhaps he's half Bolian, half Orion or something like that. But I don't think he was technically blue. But then it doesn't, you know, it doesn't bother me enough. I mean, considering that what's happened to the Romulans, the Klingons, and whatever over the Trill over the years, I'm not that worried about having to explain why one Bodian is a little on the pale side.
Well, he does kind of have a slightly creased ear, so I don't know. Maybe Vulcans. Some Vulcans was down with blue. I don't know. We'll see. I bet you both are over there going, what the hell is he talking about?
Maybe Bolians are the opposite of humans, because when we're cold, we're supposed to go blue. So maybe when they're hot, they go whiter.
Okay. Captain Tyler Scott. She made Captain faster than anyone in Starfleet history.
I know that obviously Captain Kirk himself, the original, rose through the ranks fast. But I have no problem with this, this captain being acknowledged as being the fastest riser. It's fine. A little faster, a little slower than JJ's Kirk, but...
The reason why she rose to power so quickly is because she, as we know, given something away, she's already been corrupted by another admiral who's been corrupted, so obviously he needed her in key position, so... So that's the reason she got promoted so quickly, I assume.
Oh, wow. I mean, I never put those two together. I mean,
so you reckon she was already corrupted when they had the meeting?
Yeah, she was.
I agree with Lou in the sense that I think that she was supposed to have already been taken care of by the time they had the meeting, so she's really got the alien. But I always thought that her rising through the ranks was separate. But, I mean, Lou, it's a perfectly valid opinion that perhaps she has been, promoted because she was a person that was first taken over and she, moved up the ranks accordingly. So... I think it's open to interpretation. Okay.
Walker keeps telling Picard that strange things are happening to Starfleet and maybe even his own ship. So they agree to keep this meeting secret and to covertly communicate with each other on what's going on. But as soon as Picard returns to the ship, he tells Troy. So don't you think he's implicating her?
Yes, for sure he's implicating her. But what even makes it even worse is the fact that he says he doesn't want to implicate anyone else.
And she's got to be thinking, oh, gee, thanks, Captain. I appreciate this.
Yeah, cheers for that, Matt. Thanks for the vote of support. Yeah, just drop me right in the middle of it.
And another thing is Walker, just before they break up their little meeting, says, tell Beverly I said hi. Okay, but when Crusher comes on the bridge and asks if she saw Walker, he says, no, wasn't time.
Yeah, wasn't the right time to tell her.
No, there you go. Well, it wasn't time. Okay. So then we get a disturbance in the nearby sector. What kind of disturbance? Maybe three drunks are fighting outside a pub. No, wait. That's not it. No, a pimp is beating his hooker at a nearby hotel. No. That's right. A ship was being destroyed.
And it was pretty, pretty destroyed, right? You only had some very, very, very small pieces left. You usually at least have some type of, vague shape of a primary hull or something. But this was just completely... destroy it down to small little, foot-sized pieces of
Why were there debris? No bodies? No chairs, no tables, no dogs. Oh, poor dogs. I mean, nothing. No uniforms floating around, no beds, curling irons, nothing. Just little tiny pieces of metal.
I presume they banned dogs on starships after all the mess Porthos did on Enterprise.
So, Lou, you would have preferred if there was like a corpse of a dog just floated out there as well. That would have been sad.
Or better still, a corpse of a dog sitting on a chair at a table.
Yeah, with a leash from his neck around the table. He couldn't get away. No, that wouldn't have been nice. But at least maybe a head floating around with a scared look.
That would not have got past the censors.
Okay. All right, I can see. How about a full body?
No. You got to remember, Lou, this episode was actually banned by the BBC for the ending. Never mind putting all that in.
It was banned completely, or was that just taken out?
No, it was banned completely.
I mean, I'd have to... You do watch it, and I'm surprised... Well, what time did Star Trek air in the US? Because I don't think they have had a chance of getting this onto British TV. I really don't.
Not even after 9 o'clock?
Oh, after 9 o'clock, fine. But for the, it was usually 6 o'clock. Star Trek went out at 6 on BBC Two, as far as I remember. But no chance. Absolutely no chance.
Well, I remember when TOS was in syndication, it was about 10:30 at night after the news. But I don't remember TOS, because I was working at the time, and I had to record them and watch them afterward.
Yeah, this was banned. This was the first one the BBC banned. They banned a couple of TNG episodes, but this was the first one they banned.
Okay. So, okay, now it's time to step up the implication list. Since the death of Walker Keel, it's time to bring Riker into the mix and discuss the situation. Do you guys ever notice how no one seems to appreciate Data? Not the humans, certainly not the Klingon, and now the computer.
Oh, when the computer tells you off.
Thank you, sir. I've got it. Okay, let it go. Yeah.
Yeah, I did think that was very, very funny. Even the computer thing, yeah, you're going on now, okay? You know, you're boring me. Should we get back to searching?
Right. You know. So, but, you know, it's time to go back to Earth. We're going to go visit Earth. But before we do, let's get some more people in this conspiracy plot. So we're going to tell the entire bridge crew about it. Now, do you think Ensign Tommy is currently on a subspace call with his mother about whether he should stay quiet or blow the whistle on the whole conspiracy?
Well, the interesting thing about this episode is Wesley's not in it.
Right. Right. Because Wesley probably would have, you know, alerted Starfleet of what's going on.
Actually, Wesley's not in this episode. He's not in the next episode either. And I don't think he was in We'll Always Have Paris.
Right.
So I'm kind of... I think he bows out to Skin of Evil. As far as I can tell of the first season. So that's that's a bit strange.
That's a good point.
Maybe he had to do exams.
Mm. Yeah,
in real life for me. Mm. I mean, in real life.
Or, I mean, I think more likely it's that they would have had probably child protection laws around.
Yeah, because they're only allowed to do so many hours, aren't they?
Yeah, so, you know, if you're getting to the point where schedules are tight and whatnot, then it's very easy to connect, to drop that kind of stuff and just not worry about it. But by the way, I mean, Lou, I take your point about how people are getting suspicious and people are being brought in on the conspiracy. But I think that the episode does a good job of kind of hinting about what's going on. You do get a bit of data, information, I mean, about the conspiracy. Picard does bring on Data, of course, which I think is the absolutely logical thing to do. Because he's able to trawl through the information and make some type of sense of it. And then you also don't have to worry about him misusing this information. And then I think that once Data has kind of been brought on and he's made some type of assessment of how, you know, quote unquote, real this is, I do think it's legitimate for them to start acting on this. And I do quite like the line, you know, I think it's Picard. Is it Picard or is it Riker that says, you know, what do we think we're going to do? Just warp over to headquarters and ask them what's going on. And I think Data says,
it's right,
why not?
Size.
And I think that's, by this point, I do think that I think it's real enough that they've amassed this information that it is certainly worth flagging up to, you know, to high command.
Yeah. Especially when you consider that the person who tipped you off in the first place was from high command.
Yeah, and then also, I mean, a ship has also been lost, right? So, you know, when they find, other than the pub, did you mention that the actual disturbance, you know, it was the Horatio that blew up, so it's Walker Keel's ship. So the guy that's kind of super paranoid has lost his ship. And so I think there are enough questions now to make this a legitimate, somewhat covert and somewhat, you know, have to be a bit careful, but certainly a legitimate operation on the Enterprise's side.
Okay, yep. All right, well, they arrive to Earth, and the ship is held by three admirals who are being as pleasant as they can possibly be by asking why the Enterprise has returned to Earth, you know, and why they bailed out on their mission to Pacifica. And Admiral Quinn is one of them who wants to come aboard. He is one of us now.
We are one big, flappy fleet. No, sorry, that was Khan.
Yeah, but where'd mine come from? He is one of us now.
Well, that's from Marathon Snare,
the
right?
The Packled.
With the Packleds.
Packleds, yeah.
But right, I have two things to say about the admirals. Actually, perhaps a couple more things to say, so please shout me down. First of all, Admiral Quinn, he's just looking off in some vague direction, and he seems to be completely aloof and not engaged in the situation at all. It's a little bit weird. He's just, you know, the other two are kind of looking at the view screen and they look like they're engaging with Picard, and the other admiral's just sitting there daydreaming. It is a bit strange. But the main thing
that
I think...
Seems to have used tube worms.
Perhaps. But what, Lou, what you need to do, you need to take the 3 and you have to add that to the dodgy admiral count. Because it's we've now come up, this is our, these are the second, third, and fourth dodgy admirals we come across in TNG,
okay,
I believe.
Okay, 4 dodgy admirals.
What are you going to remember though, James? In TOS, every admiral was dodgy.
Just about.
No, yeah. I'm trying to think if there's one that I can... One that wasn't, but...
No, most officers above the rank of captain were there was something wrong with them, or there was some major flaw with them, but, you know, Commodores, Admirals, Diplomats.
I was about to say Commodore Decker's probably okay, except for him being absolutely shell-shocked and you know, suffering from a Captain Ahab syndrome.
Yeah, but apart from that, he's fine.
Yes.
Apart from wanting to go into the, you know, into this, you know, the circles of hell itself, he's fine.
And constantly playing with his data chip.
Okay. Well, obviously, we find out very quickly that Quinn has been infected because, I say infected, hey, do you guys want to call it the sizzle? Hey, we haven't done the sizzle in a long time, so yes, he's got the sizzle. We heard earlier that people were affected by bluffing their way through talk of old times. And let's go back to the coming of age again when Quinn had the following concerns, and I'm paraphrasing here. Some of us at Starfleet Command have become concerned about certain problems within the Federation. Someone or something is trying to destroy the fabric of everything we've built up in the last 200 years. He didn't know if the threat came from the inside or the outside, so he wanted to promote Picard to Admiral and take over as Commandant of Starfleet Academy. Now, we flash forward today, and he says what he meant was the problem of assimilating new races into the Federation. It's an ongoing and tumultuous process that can cause stress and strain on every aspect of our alliance. Wow. Could you smell the BS out there?
You can, by the way, you can. There's a certain shift, and there is something that has happened. But at the same time, I think it's close enough that Picard, it's not as if he's so certain that he can act completely and, you know, arrest him on the spot for being an imposter. So I do like that about this episode. It is, you, in a strange way, you get all these hints that something's wrong. And it's clear that something's wrong, and you're heading in that direction. Even when you go down and sit down with the admirals, and they're having their food and stuff like that, there's something wrong. But you can like almost you can see it's wrong, but you can't be certain. But you're heading down this direction of it being more and more wrong as the episode proceeds. So I really do like the callback, and I do think that they handled it very well. You can see in other cases, right, if it hadn't been Picard himself, but if Picard had told one of his officers, and then one of his officers had run into Quinn, and then Quinn tried to bluff it by saying, well, we're talking about the cultural identity of Starfleet, given all these new species coming in, it might have worked in those circumstances. So I think it's very good, and I think it's very good that they keep this, that they keep this bit of uncertainty in the back of the viewer's mind. But when just directly after you leave the viewer screen with the three admirals, and Quinn has kind of said that he wants to come up to the Enterprise, it's actually a nice scene because you end up the viewers left, and you know, the cast mentioned this, but you're kind of given the indication that perhaps Quinn wants to see them on the side because he's still on their side. So there's a little bit of a switch that you think, well, he's still on our side. He must be trustworthy. He wasn't talking to the captain in a bad way on the viewer screen, and he wants to see them in private, so he must be on our side. And then you realize that it's really not that when he has the little, you know, the little pink monster in the suitcase. And I do like it how it does play with these things. There's no reason for them to have Quinn being on our side and then against us within the 30-second window, other than the fact that it's actually nicely written and well-written episode. It could have easily they could have easily forgotten about that. And I do like it. I think there's a lot there that is a lot there that really keeps the viewer on their toes.
Yeah. Well, if you hadn't remembered the previous thing about something destroying the fabric of the Federation, and then he just BS's his way through this one, you would have thought, okay. And then Picard, you know, he points out that that's not Gregory. There's something wrong here. So, but they beam down, and like you say, they have an interesting dinner.
Yeah, which raises a very important point. Does no one in the future actually drink Earth tea?
Well, Earl Grey hot.
Because every time they have, no, but it's like, we'll have some Andorian tea when you're on DS9. Yeah. It's Tekalian tea. And it's like that. There's only Captain Picard who drinks Earth tea.
I mean, doesn't technically, T'Pol, she drinks chamomile tea, mm-hmm. I think. But also, one thing that you do always get, and this is, it's a bit of a weakness in Star Trek, right? Is that whenever you're referring to something from another planet, so in on Earth, you have, you know, Earl Grey tea, which is a particular type of tea drunk in a particular part of Earth, almost maybe at a particular time of day. Whereas everything else, when you reference other planets, it's always Tarkadian tea, assuming that the Tarkadians are a homogenous race that drink tea, and they don't have any variety of tea. And
Andorian ale.
And you think, well, Romulan ale, I mean, if someone said human ale, what could you get if you just asked for human ale? That there's a wide variety of ale you could get. Even if you just concentrate on a very specific type of ale, there's still a wide variety of ale. But
it's like, it's Romulan like ale? It's like this Klingon coffee.
Actually, I always had a problem with Ractigino. It was too cute a name for me to imagine that warriors were ordering it.
All I can think of is when the preservers were like seeding the galaxy, what they also did is they planted coffee and tea at the same time as they were seeding the primordial pools. Because they knew that when all these humanoids grew up, that they would have something to drink, and it would be tea and coffee on every solitary planet.
Yes, it's the common ancestry.
Yeah, it's common ancestry.
Go. That makes sense.
But just jumping back a bit, because with the conspiracy side of it and the admirals and all that type of stuff, is when they have that secret meeting, one ship is destroyed, right? Picard makes no attempt to contact the other captains. How does he know they haven't been destroyed?
Yeah, they did say they were going to stay in touch covertly.
Yeah. Yeah,
that makes sense.
So, and then also, the other thing is, like, obviously, this admiral is acting completely different to the way he was acting last time. And we see in Star Trek, in other stories, where someone acting out of character is a clue to the fact that they're not who they are.
Well, he beats down Riker and Geordi, and or even Worf, too.
Yeah, well, Geordi's not really, you know, beating Geordi down. It's not really major, is it, you know?
So, I basically said there that he said, well, he beat up Geordi, he completely wiped the floor with him. No, he could be a 70-year-old admiral. We're still not sure.
Yeah, we're still not sure. He just beat up the first in command, the head of security, and the man who will be our chief engineer.
Yeah.
But no, he's fine. He's just had his vitamins.
Vitamins. They work wonders for the body. Okay.
Yeah. I do think it was funny, though, that the person who defeated him was the doctor.
Yeah, after three shots.
You know, all the men are being macho and fighting him. She goes, can I suck this? Bang.
Yeah. Took a couple shots of the phaser, but she finally took him down.
Yeah. What they wanted is her to turn around after she shot him and went,
Man. they're never the same the next morning. Okay, well, anyway, so they're sitting down to dinner. Picard opens his bowl to find some kind of worms. You know, they must have been really tasty, because did you notice everyone else is eating them by the handfuls? I mean, what?
Do you know what they were? Chow mein noodles.
Oh, is that what that was?
That's what it is. They're eating chow mein noodles.
Oh, nice. I mean, they were spilling them like pigs all over the place.
Yeah, they're eating chow mein noodles. And I actually thought when I was watching this scene that if this insect race had started with the Ferengi, no one would have known any different.
That's right. Absolutely. I have to say, though, I mean, remembering this, remember watching this as a kid, I was freaked out by the worms being eaten. I really was. I mean, I suppose it's not that horrendous, but it's certainly something that I remember being really kind of like turned off by.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because they had an awful lot of reservations about this entire episode. So what they did is they got one of the production crew's kids to watch it. I've got it in my notes. Hang on, let me have a look. Let me look. Dan Curry. Dan Curry invited his six-year-old son to watch the episode in order to see how a child would react to it. He liked it so much that Berman then gave it the green light. So the test subject for this episode was a six-year-old boy.
Makes perfect sense. Okay. Well, anyway, Picard tries to back out of the room and he's stopped by Riker. Oh, no. Okay, did you guys really believe Riker was affected this way?
The first time I watched it, yes, after he stood up in sickbay and scared the bejeebus out of the doctor.
Yes. Actually, can I just also say that is a great scene, because you see the doctor and you potentially think it's Quinn or someone that has got her, and the way that Riker scares the doctor is very, very good. And yep. I thought entirely that, okay, now Riker's been taken over. I didn't see the double bluff come in. But by the way, I mean, I'm 12 at this point, so don't think that I'm a million miles ahead.
That's
of the
what I mean. The first time I watched this, I genuinely thought Riker had been turned. Because the other thing that works with that premise is it's also near the end of the run.
Right. He'll be one of us soon. And then, of course, Captain Scott walks in, and that's when they say, you didn't think we were completely in the dark in what you were doing. So that's why I knew Captain Scott was in on it the whole time.
Yeah.
Okay. But just when you think Riker is with them, he pulls out his phaser and blasts the only junior officer in the room.
And I did like the fact it was a Mark II phaser.
Oh, yes.
The little pocket phaser from TOS.
You know, I always thought that the Mark II phaser actually just fits into the body of the standard phaser that they use.
It did in TOS.
Yeah, okay. But not, you know, because it didn't have TNG.
No, TNG is two different phasers. But it is nice to know that in the future, the phasers have another setting. You know, apart from warm up, rock, cut door, stun, kill, we find out in this episode that phasers in the future also have blow your head off settings.
Yes. Yes, it does. I guess if you just, you know, stay on it a little longer. Okay. So anyway, now, first he gets a junior officer, then he gets Captain Scott, and then the Vulcan captain hits Riker with the Vulcan. What? Pain pinch?
Well, he's trying to do the Vulcan stun. And the only thing that I could make sense of, the reason why he couldn't get it to work, is because he wasn't pure Vulcan, so to speak.
Okay.
Because we've seen Spock do that, and it's seconds.
Yeah, just instantly almost.
Yeah, but also, I mean, Kirk's chop to the neck also takes someone out in seconds, doesn't it?
Yeah, but it's Kirk. It's Kirk. I mean, this is the man who body slams three people.
But I have to say, I don't want the Vulcan neck pinch to be brought down to the level of the Kirk chop.
No.
But so, yeah, I certainly think that he should have. I mean, I don't like it when people try to. People should not be allowed to resist the Vulcan neck pinch. So perhaps the Admiral was either just extremely old, or, you know, not on top form that day, or half ruminant or whatever. Oh.
Well, he's got the creature inside him, so he might not be able to access the Vulcan.
No, that's also true. Yeah,
yeah. The only other person I know who'd done the Vulcan thing was Data.
Yes, yes. And I mean that's I like that when that happened. That was one of my favorite episodes. When that came up, it was a big issue for me, because I was watching like TNG regularly at that point. It was a big event, and one of my favorite character. Well, actually, I think my favorite character is Data, and when he does the Vulcan neck pinch in Unification, it's great.
Yeah. Actually, Leonard Nimoy was doing a convention about that and actually asked him, when are you going to do an episode of TNG? And he turned around to the audience at the convention and said, I already have done. And that was the first time anyone knew about it.
You know, to a certain extent, those were the, I'm not going to say good old days, because I don't think, you know, you're pretty romanticising the past slightly. But can you imagine now people just not knowing that there's going to be a major star in one of the major TV shows? You wouldn't be able to keep that silence.
No. I mean, we all knew that he was in 2009.
Absolutely.
We all knew that. They tried to hush it up, but we all knew it.
Okay. All right. So anyway, after all the phaser firing,
Luke, sorry. First of all, I do apologize for this. I really, really do. But why are phasers so slow? Because phasers in this
You can strike a pose.
In this particular episode, phasers are really slow. They're slower than a bullet. Clearly, right. They're slower than a light gun. In this case, they look like they're slower than actually throwing a rock at someone.
What you're going to remember with phasers, though, James, is you have to strike a pose before you shoot them.
Yes, and so stay still.
Yes.
So the person you're shooting at also has to strike a pose. And if he hasn't struck the pose, then he's allowed to move out the way.
Yes, but no, I think what James is getting at is when Admiral Aaron, he's running down the hallway as Riker and Picard are chasing him, and Picard screams, Aaron! And he turns around, fires his phaser, and you can actually see
it. Yeah, and Picard does his Neo bit and moves out the way.
Yeah, but you could see the light. They had plenty of time to get out of its way.
His battery was low.
You could almost outrun this phaser beam.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think you should be able to outrun a phaser beam.
What it was is his phaser wasn't running on Duracell.
Oh, ever ready, huh?
Ever ready.
Well, anyway.
The beam's slower.
But, the guy wasn't slow enough because Picard and Riker get to double kidney shot him with their phasers.
Yeah.
That's absolutely correct, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I was watching it frame by frame, and you could see the phaser hit frame by frame. You shouldn't be able to. It should be almost instantaneous. Just like a bullet from a gun. There's no way you can get away out of the way.
Well, technically a phaser is supposed to travel at the speed of light.
Well, if that's the case, then they're really wrong. I mean, shoot someone with a gun and let them see if they can get out of the way in time.
Because all you're seeing from the phaser is, as a person watching it, you're seeing the light off the energy beam.
Right.
So, but if you fire, if you fire a laser, you're actually seeing the laser after it's traveled.
Mm-hmm. So they would have already been hit.
Now, by the way, I was listening to Previous in the Alpha Quadrant a couple of weeks ago, and they had a quiz between Matt and Data Logan, and I think it was between them. And it was brought up at that point. Actually, I'm talking nonsense. It wasn't that. It was when Mark was on previously. But on one of these quiz shows that they had a question about, what is a phaser? What exactly is it? And they mentioned that it was some type of particle beam. And I always thought it was like high energy laser, as in high energy light, which would travel at the speed of light. But they seem to suggest that it was some type of actual particle beam, which may not travel at the speed of light. So I was just left really confused after that.
Okay. Well, anyway, the spider creature crawls out of his mouth and enters the room where Remick is sitting, in Admiral Jameson's chair, no less.
He is.
Yeah, minus the front doors.
But we haven't mentioned really that Remick is, he's in the background in this a lot, right? So he's one of the guys that's been with the admirals, and you kind of assume relatively early on he must be also in on the conspiracy, but you don't have any definite proof until you effectively get to this scene, and it's a great scene.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and that spider thing crawls up Remick's body right into his mouth and takes over, and you don't understand.
Yeah, James, a phaser is a directed energy weapon. So that's what it is. It's a directed energy weapon with various settings. The energy setting dictates the amount of damage done by the phaser. which is why you have stun, kill, blah, blah, blah.
An explodo head.
An explodo head, yeah. So it's our directed energy weapon.
Okay.
So it's kind of like a 23rd and 24th century stun gun, perhaps.
Yeah, it's a taser on steroids.
Yeah, a taser. There you go, a taser. Okay, anyway. We mean you no harm. We only seek peaceful coexistence. I don't think so. So Picard and Riker, you know, phaser his head off. Ew.
I love that effect.
Yeah.
You know, and the fact that when you can see the wind this was and stuff like that, and the amount, I mean, do you know the backstory behind this, either of you two?
No. Go ahead.
Right, basically what Michael Westmore got called in to do this episode, and the bulging of his neck is air bladders.
Yeah.
Right, which is under his skin, and the blowing up the head bit is basically they filled the head mold with raw meat.
Ew.
And then blew it up.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. But
because this was before CGI and stuff like that, so, you know. Well, they had CGI, obviously, but it was in its infancy.
Right. Yeah. And it's kind of funny they just blow up his head. I mean, it's really funny just from the skin in.
Yeah, I love the way that that wasn't the end of it, that the alien queen, for want of a better way of putting it, then come up and then they shot that as well.
Right.
What do you do to me?
Or whatever. Anyway. You know, something I also never noticed is that after it's all said and done, laying on the ground were a lot of those little creatures.
Yeah, but that was all dead because they can't live without. They actually say that they can't live without the queen.
I wonder why.
Well, this was going to be the resident baddie, and instead they went with the Borg.
Right.
So what I always think of is, with the Borg, if you kill the queen, you kill the ship. So I always likened it to that analogy.
Mm. That does make sense. Okay, and they're just laying all over.
And I was also going to say, I mean, it gives a very easy way, right, to just to end the episode. So clearly, if all of them within the vicinity die when this one dies, then you don't have a problem to clean up. Whereas if they stay alive, then effectively you've not really achieved much by the end of the episode. And I think that despite people wanting to have continual storylines and stuff, you kind of need to wrap up most of the show as the credits roll. So
yeah,
the only problem with that premise,
though, James, is what about the ones that were in the star bases?
Oh no, I think that's true. And you know, are you suggesting that we kind of raised this with 11001001, which is, you know, how connected are you to either the planet or how connected are these to the queen? Because if you're going to say that he's 5 million light years away, then you're probably not going to be that connected to the queen. I mean, how can you be? Are you in contact with them over subspace?
Well, you could do that with the Borg mentality as well, because they got the hive mind. Because the Borg are connected across subspace by the mind, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah. And I always assumed, although, I mean, I felt the Borg were a little easier in the sense that I think that it was almost, I think it was a decentralized clustering with the Borg. So it wasn't that there was, okay, maybe by the time Voyager came along, it didn't behave like this. But I always felt that the Borg, when they were working their best, it was more that there was a kind of everyone connected, made up the hive mind, rather than the hive mind was one person connected to everyone else. If that makes sense.
Yeah, I know what you mean. So each individual ship was the hive.
And then the interactions between those ships as well was important. Yes. But it wasn't that there was one person on the other side of the galaxy controlling people.
It was more like a nest of ants.
Yes, yeah, I think so.
Okay. So let's go a little bit further into the future and talk about Admiral Sati. Because at the end of this one, we hear that Remick was actually sending out a message. It was a homing beacon sent from Earth, which would imply that there's something in the future. But other than a remarking pass of an alien conspiracy that Admiral Satie exposed, do you think they're referring to this moment or another alien conspiracy?
These were going to be the bad people of TNG, because when they realized their Ferengi didn't work.
Yeah.
So these were going to be the bad people of TNG, and then they realized that they couldn't do this because the cost would have been exorbitant. So they then went with the Borg.
Mm. And the Romulans.
Yeah, which you'll cover next week. Mm-hmm. But it basically comes down to a cost thing.
Okay. But I'm still trying to figure out, they say that Admiral Satie exposed the alien conspiracy against Starfleet. Well, this is the only one I can think of.
Someone's got to get the credit.
Oh, not Picard, huh?
Nah. Hmm.
Didn't Admiral Satie direct Picard to take over the Enterprise? Or wasn't she on the orders? So, you know, hey, if you've assigned Picard and Picard saves the day, then, you know, eventually the credit rolls up to her, right?
That's right.
Oh, that's how management works.
Okay, well, unless you guys have anything else, I think it's time to go on to our final thoughts and rating.
No, I'm done.
I'm good as well.
Okay, then. It's now time to give our rating for this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. Me? I'm going to go first. I like the dark tones of this episode. The promise of things yet to come not panning out pales to the fear in everyone's face when they realize this isn't quite over. I mean, there's something else going to happen, whether it did or not. You know, we didn't know at the time. The only time we see this kind of uncertainty and fear is in season 2, episode in which Q flings the Enterprise to the Delta Quadrant and Picard realizes they will be coming. I like the conspiracy aspect and the build-up from the moment the code 47 to the head exploding on Remick. The fact that the network squirmed over this part and how it was never shown in its original UK version of this episode makes me realize that, you know, I kind of like that as well. Okay, I have not given a 5 to any episode in season 1. I kind of would like to do that today, but in the end, I don't know. I have a hard time pulling that 5 trigger. But it's a little better than a 4, and since we decided, or actually it was Paula who decided that we should change our rating system, I'll go with the 4.5. You know, maybe, you know, 4.25. I'll go 4.5 in the end. What about you, Colin? How are you feeling?
I personally think this is a brilliant episode. When you do some delving into it, and you look around the background behind it. They originally wanted to do a Star Trek conspiracy where you have renegade officers taking over. But Gene wouldn't let them do that because that's not Starfleet. So they went through a load of ideas and rewrites and everything to come up with this. And these were going to be the new baddies, as we've already said. Unfortunately, it was derailed by the writer's strike. So they went down a different path. And also, as we said, the costs and all that. And it's not referred to again until Drumhead. And the show that you're going to do next, which is The Neutral Zone, was going to be the introduction to the Borg.
Was it?
Yeah, but again, the writer's strike. So a writer's strike derailed an awful lot of the planning for Star Trek. But that said, the fact that so early on in the run of the show, they was thinking continuity, they was thinking, we need a new baddie, we need to set the scene, we need to do this episode, then we're going to do the neutral episode, and then we're going to drop feeders and trailers, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that, and it's going to feed all the way through Next Generation about these beings that are going to try and take over the Federation. The vision alone for what they was trying to do with this in relation to the entire run of the show is breathtaking. And, you know, when the characters in this really good, the acting was really good. As we've said, Wesley wasn't in it. To some people, that's a good thing. Chris Ball is a brilliant director. The script and everything is really, really good. We don't get a lot of the support cast, so to speak, it's essentially Riker, Picard, Data. But I personally would give this a 5.
Okay.
Because for the vision that he was planning, what they achieved, and, you know, this was the first one the BBC banned as well.
Right.
You know, this is how much they was pushing the envelope. The BBC turned around and goes, oh, no, we're not showing that. So,
wow. Hey, let me ask you something. You referenced the Borg and that this was going to be the, or I'm sorry, the neutral zone was going to be the introduction to the Borg. So do I gather that maybe because the outposts were all scooped up on both sides of the neutral zone that perhaps you think the Borg did it? Because I always thought maybe it was a crystalline entity.
No, it wasn't the Borg. If when they actually say they were scooped up, that then plays into the best of both worlds when Shelby says, when they beam down to the planet and the planet, the colony's been scooped out.
Right.
And Shelby says, that's our Borg footprint.
But it seems to me, in when they get flung into the Delta Quadrant, that the Borg knew did not know who they were, but they do now.
No, but if you think about it, where the outposts were attacked were on the Romulan Federation border, so it's right on the edge of Romulan space. And they was, I think it was 2.5 years away from Starfleet when they got flew, when they got thrown into the Borg's clutches. They was 2.5 years away from Starfleet at maximum warp. So you've got to think that the neutral zone is going to be right on the edge of Federation space in regards to the Romulans. And also, in the best of both worlds, Picard says it would be clear their technology is way behind what we envisioned, meaning that their ability to travel vast distances surpasses anything that Starfleet have.
Okay, so do you think that they appeared, scooped up these outposts, and then took off back toward the Delta Quadrant?
Yeah, it's standard military tactics. You go in, you probe the enemy, you get information, you report back, gather your forces, plan your attack, and then go in.
Oh, fascinating. And then when they Q happened to fling them there, that's when they picked up more on the Enterprise and the Federation.
Yeah, and they knew their weapons capabilities. You wouldn't get someone's military capability from attacking in a listening post.
Fascinating. All this time, I always thought this was a hint of the crystalline entity came up and scooped everything. And because then I thought, well, you know, the crystalline entity only went for living beings, even seeds and their greenery, but not entire buildings. And
No. The neutral zone was going to introduce the Borg. And then because of the Writer's Strike, the Borg storyline got pushed back. And so they had to reintroduce the Borg in a different way, which is when Q comes into it.
Right. Fascinating. I like the way they did it there in QU. Yeah. So
if they hadn't had the Writer's Strike, the Borg would have been introduced in Season 2 in a different way.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right, James. I'm sorry. Go ahead and do your thoughts, unless you have something more on this.
By the way, I think we'll probably touch on it next time when we do in the Neutral Zone as well, because something that I've noticed... Certainly at the end of Season 1, right, we seem to have two episodes that really did attempt to be kind of like season finales. So this one is, because there's the big, you know, big climax, and there's this, you know, mysterious signal that gets sent out, and you don't know what else is coming. And then the Neutral Zone effectively does the same thing with the, you know, with either the new threat that people don't know about, and also the Romulans being, you know, quote-unquote, their back. So it seems a bit weird that TNG has these two kind of semi-endings at the end of the Season 1.
But they ended it with the wrong one.
Perhaps. Now, I'm actually going to just consider this episode entirely on its own, because I hear what Colin was saying about what they're trying to set up here, and I think it's nice that it follows on from Coming of Age, and it doesn't lead into anything else, per se. But I actually don't think that's much... I don't think that's really that much of a issue for me, at least. I think this episode can stand alone, and I don't think it is necessarily diminished by the fact that you know the last lines aren't followed up, and so I believe they are followed up in the books. I frankly love it. I think it's a really good build-up. I think the execution works very well. You are right in the sense that this is a, you know, Captain Picard Riker kind of centric show. It's a, you know, it's a main action piece. It's a highlight of the series, and I think it works very well. I like the I think as we've spoken, the build up works very well. I was surprised by Quinn turning. I was interested in the fact you've got these aliens that have taken over people. I like how Riker goes down and how, you know, Picard's put into a situation where, at the time that I first saw it, I thought, well, he's not getting out of there very easily. I have to say, and I'll just say a couple of things, what I was thinking when they have the Remick scene at the end, because I think it's such a great scene. So as they chase the creature into there, and at first you don't know whether or not Remick's been taken, and then the creature climbs up his leg, and you think, ooh, that's a bit weird, and then he eats the creature, and I'm like, wow! And then his neck starts going, and you're thinking, where the hell is this heading? And he utters the lines about, you know, we seek peaceful coexistence, and you're thinking, yeah, I don't think so. And then, obviously, head kablamo, creature out of gut, blown up. It's all great. And I love this episode. I'm giving this a 5 out of 5, in my opinion. This is the second best episode of season one.
Okay.
I love that kablamo. I love that.
Kablamo.
Okay. All right, then. I guess we can call this one done.
On the next episode of Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Commander, look at this.
The crew discovers frozen survivors from the 20th century.
What's going to happen to us?
In the middle of a perilous mission to confront arch enemies.
You think that we attacked your outposts?
Could this feared encounter spark an explosive battle?
I recommend we go immediately to battle stations.
Find out on Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Well then, join us next week as we review Season 1, Episode 26, the season finale, otherwise known as the Neutro Zone. I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And I'm James from London.
And I'm Colin from Warwickshire.
Thank you, and good night.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.